Les colloques du Collège de France.
So in between I can start with the introduction. So our next presenter is Ophelia Rons. She is also a CNRS researcher. She is a research director at the Institute for Sciences of Evolution in Montpellier. She is broadly interested by the interactions between demography and evolutionary dynamics in spatially heterogeneous environments, with an expertise in theoretical evolutionary biology. Her research questions encompass the evolution of dispersal, life history, local adaptation, ecological niches, and species ranges. These theoretical studies inform our understanding of genetic adaptation processes to global change, including responses to changes in connectivity and climate, and of how these processes could integrate in conservation and management of various species. Welcome, Ophelia. The floor is yours, please.
Thank you, Peter. So I'm going to be the evolutionary biologist of this symposium, presenting things from a different perspective. And I'm going to be talking about evolutionary potential. So first, I would like to acknowledge my current collaborators on this project, Emmanuel Fraunhofer from ISEM, and especially Tsuko Nonaka, who is doing a Marie Curie project in the lab and helped me preparing this presentation, also motivated me to engage again with questions that I tackled at the beginning of my career and that were sleeping a bit for a while. So the first starting point of my presentation is that functional traits that are important for ecosystem functioning, they do not only vary between species, but they generally always vary within species. So this is just one example of a study conducted by Julie Gauzer, where she sampled seeds on different beech trees across some altitudinal elevation gradient in the Mont Ventoux. So you can see the three sites, N4, N2, N1, that are at different elevation with different temperature and different summer precipitation. And those seeds were planted in a common garden, and she measured a lot of functional ecological traits on the little seedlings in the common garden. And because she genotyped everybody, she could reconstruct the pedigree of trees and their parentage relationship, and so she could estimate from the total phenotypic variation the part of this variation for traits that is heritable and will be transmitted to the next generation in the population. So in this example, you can see that one trait, leaf carbon isotope composition, is variable between individuals, and part of this variation is heritable. But the three sites have the same distribution of this trait. So there's no variation between sites in the distribution of this trait, but this is variation within any site. But for other traits, such as butt bust date, you can see that there are also variations within sites, but also across sites, and in particular, little trees from higher elevation, they open their buds in the spring earlier in the common garden than little trees that are coming from lower elevation. So why do we care about variation of functional trait within species and within populations? Because this heritable variation is the fuel for any evolutionary change. So because functional traits, they affect fitness, they are necessarily under selection and potentially different selection depending on environmental condition, and they determine the speed of evolution. So I will illustrate that with this example. So in many flies, fly geneticists, they have the common habit of selecting for some traits in lab condition. So for instance, in different species of fly, if you select for desiccation resistance, you expose flies to stress, you select the flies that survive to the stress, and you start a new generation from those flies. And very rapidly, as you can see with cross triangles and open circles for different fly species. If you do that, in only a few generations, you're going to have a very large increase in desiccation tolerance in the experimental population you're applying selecting on. But the group of Ari Hoffman in Melbourne applied the same type of experiment on a fly species coming from the tropical forest, which is a specialist of this very wet, constantly wet environment. And they tried very hard for many generations to select for increased desiccation tolerance, and they never managed to obtain flies that were more tolerant to drought, while in other fly species you obtain a very fast response. And the reason why they never managed to obtain any response to selection is that this species of fly has lost completely heritable variation for this trait, and even lost the ability to generate variation through mutation for this trait. So we could say, okay, variation for functional traits are important for evolution, but do we care about that as ecologists? And when we do landscape ecology, do we care about evolution? Maybe evolution is taking place at some different temporal scale, and we don't need to worry about it to understand the ecological process we are dealing with functional ecology. However, I would claim that it's often not the case, and that the temporal scale of evolution and ecology are increasingly recognized as being really comparable and similar in many situations. So I will illustrate that through different examples. But one that I will start with is a model we've been built during my postdoc in Texas with Mark Patrick, which was at the beginning very much inspired by a discussion we had with Mike Singer, who is a butterfly specialist, and has documented again and again many very rapid shifts in host use in butterfly species in different complex landscapes. And in particular, some cases where there were an abrupt retraction in the host range of some butterfly species following some disturbance, such as a summer frost, and irreversible shift so that the former host of the butterfly was not recognized despite the disturbance being some time away. This happened in only a few years. So to model the situation, we considered the most simple landscape you can imagine with only two patches. So I know this is very frustrating for you, but for me, I think we can learn already a lot from this very idealized situation. So you've got two patches, one with one host plant and another with another host plant, and the butterflies can move at random between those patches of plants. And what we assume is that there is a relationship between some functional trait and the fitness of the butterflies under different host plants. So that, for instance, success of clutch laid on different host plants depend on trait of the butterflies, such as the position where they lay their eggs on the plant, or the timing of the laying, or any quantitative trait you can imagine. So there are different optimal values maximizing the fitness of the butterflies under different host plants. And what we assume is that if the phenotype or the trait of the butterfly do not match this optimal value on the different host plant, then there are demographic consequences for that, in that the clutch size or the clutch success will decrease, and the population size of butterfly will decline in the patch where the butterflies are maladapted. So with this simple model, we can show that the evolution of the niche of the butterfly, so the range of hosts they use and to which they are adapted to, varies critically depending on different parameters that are, in particular, they vary critically depending on how much heritable variation within each habitat we have for the functional trait that determines success on a different host plant, and the movement rate between habitat. So if you have a landscape such as you have high heritable variation for the adaptive trait and a relatively low movement rate between habitat, then the species in this landscape evolves a niche such as it's a generalist, it uses both host plant, has similar density of butterflies on the different patches, and has some level of differentiation in trait distribution across the different host plants. Conversely, if heritable trait variation for the functional trait is low and the movement rate between habitat is high, then the niche evolves so that the butterfly actually use only one host in the landscape. And part of the patches with alternative hosts are not used by the butterflies or have a very low density of butterflies on them. And if you look at the distribution of functional trait value across the two patches in the landscape, you find very little differentiation, very little genetic diversity across patches in the distribution of traits. And interestingly, what you have is that there's also, if the genetic variation is low and the movement rate between habitat is also low, you have a part of the parameter space where actually the niche can evolve to be a generalist with a broad niche or a specialist with a narrow niche, depending on initial condition. And this means that if you are in this area of parameter space, and you start, as in the example that we discussed with Mike Singer, with the butterfly he was studying, if you start with a general species that is using two host plants in the landscape, and comes a summer frost killing specifically the butterflies on one of the host plants, then there's, of course, a crash in the population size on this host plant. But after this disturbance, the population never recovers, and the population density on the second habitat remains low, while the density on the first habitat increases and specialization on this habitat increases. So you can have a very rapid evolution of the species niche following a disturbance in this landscape. So this effect of abrupt shift in niche, and also the fact that those changes cannot be reversed easily, are due to the fact that these models include some feedbacks between evolution and population dynamics. So what is going on in the model is that if you start with a small density in one type of habitat in the landscape, then because of the low density in those rare habitats, or in habitats where for some historical reason the density has decreased, then the proportion of the population that will be immigrants coming from outside this patch will be large, which means that the impact of gene flow from the wrong habitat, from the other habitat in those little patches will be high. And this high gene flow coming from the wrong habitat will introduce genetic variation or heritable variation that was selected elsewhere, increasing the maladaptation of those small population in the marginal habitat. And this increased maladaptation will make the density even smaller because of the relationship between maladaptation and density. And the population is caught into some kind of evolutionary trap in this vicious circle of increasing maladaptation and decreasing size. However, this vicious circle can be stopped if the evolution potential within each patch is high, because then there will be a lot of genetic diversity to resist the maladaptive effect of gene flow, so response to selection will be very efficient, and so you can stop this circle going on if evolutionary potential is high. So at this point, I assume that this is all well, but you're all frustrated because a two-patch landscape is not a landscape according to your standards. So, but this model was later used in more realistic landscape to address similar questions. So this is just an example of an actual real network of patches of different host plants studied by the team of Patrick Nozell and collaborators, where you've got those stick insects that are cryptic on different host plants, and so you've got different morphs that are genetically determined, that when the wrong morph is on the wrong host plant, you've got a very high mortality due to bird predation and a lower population size. And so they use the same kind of model, but in this more realistic landscape, and they could predict, for instance, the fraction of the green morph in different patches in the landscape and compare that to the actual observed fraction of green morph in the landscape. So it matched quite okay, but it's a bit cheating because they kind of adjusted the model with the data. So this is not a very strong test, but it works okay. But more interestingly for me, what they did also in this model is they tried to see what is the ecological impact of this eco-evolutionary feedbacks and the fact that you've got evolution affecting patch occupancy in the landscape. And so what they compare in this graph here is a predicted patch occupancy, so which patch in this complex landscape are occupied by the stick insect and which patch are empty, compared to the same prediction in a model where you could artificially cut the link between maladaptation and population demography. So you could say in the model, so the beauty of models is that you can play with reality and test hypotheses. So you could say, okay, let's imagine that the extinction colonization rates of every patch does not depend on the phenotypic composition and the match of the phenotype with the local optimum. And if you do that, you can see that you can see by comparing those predictions with the feedback and without, that with the feedback, part of the landscape is not used. So because of evolution of the niche, you've got a lower patch occupancy and incidence in the landscape than if you were assuming that demography was independent of maladaptation because of the evolution of the niche. So there were, I don't have time to tell you about, there is also more work on the spatial complex metapopulation, looking at the spatial scale of local adaptation and genetic diversity, depending on the configuration of gene flow and the configuration of the landscape. But one big problem with all those models that we discuss is that they assume that the evolutionary potential, so it's a critical determinant of the spatial patterns of abundance in heterogeneous landscape, but they assume that this heritable variation within every patch is itself constant through space and through time. But actually, this evolutionary potential, this diversity for adaptive traits, is also affected in reverse by the spatial patterns of abundance in heterogeneous landscapes. And this is something that those previous models ignore. So now I want to tackle this question of how does landscape configuration affect the maintenance of variation, heritable variation for adaptive traits. So there's a huge theoretical literature about that. So in particular, in this kind of Bible of quantitative genetics, which is this book by Walsh and Lynch, there's a very long chapter discussing all different models that were published about the maintenance of genetic variation, which has been a puzzle for many, many years, and a subject of very fierce debate and paradox starting in the 70s until the early 2000s. And so, for instance, the author kind of heroically attempted a kind of classification of the different types of models and what they considered to consider the maintenance of quantitative genetic variation. And there was a lot of discussion about the number of genes involved in quantitative traits, the effect of mutation, their distribution of effects, their strengths, their abundance. And all those models basically still ended up in a paradoxical situation that, given what we know about mutation rate and selection, they failed to explain the amount of genetic variation we see for adaptive traits in real populations. And you can see that, but most of those models consider homogeneous environments and very simple ecology, basically. And there's only one little box where all the complexity of ecology is represented, which is balancing selection models. And globally, this is really not discussed in much details. However, from a long time, we know that if we look at spatial heterogeneity and gene flow, those are sufficient to explain the maintenance of very large evolutionary potential compared to what you would expect for the same mutation rate in a single homogeneous environment. So this is just one example that we explored with Sebastian Lopez The maintenance of heritable variation for quantitative traits in a patchy landscape with, again, two habitats, but where we wanted to test whether seed dispersal or pollen dispersal was able to maintain more variation. And we found, indeed, that if you measure habitat heterogeneity by the distance between the optimum between the two habitat in the landscape, as you increase this habitat heterogeneity for a reasonable level of gene flow, be it by seed dispersal or pollen dispersal, you very significantly increase the amount of variation that you maintain in the landscape. And this result was found by many studies before and after us in different contexts. And interestingly, the fact that the theoretical prediction that you should maintain more variation in more heterogeneous landscapes was confirmed by very few empirical studies, but some, because it's kind of difficult actually to test it empirically. So in this study, Yeman and Jarvis, they also grew species of trees in a common garden. And what they did is that they looked at phenotypic variation in the common garden, assuming it would be a good proxy of heritable variation. And they connected that to the heterogeneity in environmental condition in the region around which the location where the trees, the seeds were sampled, within a typical pollen dispersal distance of this tree, which is quite large. And what you can see is that, indeed, the variance for growth of the tree is well explained by the heterogeneity in the region around the population for different environmental variables related to drought, precipitation, cold, or temperature. Interestingly as well, in the study by Julie Gauzer that I mentioned at the beginning of this talk, what she did is that with genetic markers, she could identify or she could assess the probability that the seeds were sired by a father sending pollen from a far distance from the local population. And again, she found that the heritable trait variation would increase with the probability of a long-distance pollen dispersal. However, the relationship between genetic variation and dispersal or habitat heterogeneity are more complex than those simple predictions suggest. So first of all, if you look at, without any feedback between demography and adaptation, if you look at the heritable variation, you can see that there's actually some intermediate movement rate that maximizes the variation. And if the movement rate is too high, you actually homogenize completely the diversity across your landscape and you lose variation. But if you introduce feedback in the system, you also have a different behavior in that it looks for a rate of movement quite similar to what happens without those feedbacks. But you also have a critical migration rate where suddenly the genetic diversity that you maintain in the landscape goes from a pretty high level to the level you expect in a homogeneous population, despite the migration rate being very high. You also have a strong dependency on initial conditions. So the red symbol on this graph shows a situation where you started from a situation where you had a lot of individuals in some habitat and very little individuals in the other habitat. And you can see in this situation where you start from a very asymmetric situation, actually, despite the increase in the movement rate between habitats, you never increase the evolutionary potential. So you're stuck in an evolutionary trap where actually the feedback loop I describe is kind of enhanced by the evolution of heritable variation. So if you have a small density, you have increased impact of gene flow, but no gene flow is both increasing maladaptation but also making heritable variation smaller because it's making you more similar to what's going on in the large patches, and then you trapped in this situation, and this positive feedback loop is also enhanced by genetic and demographic stochasticity, which also make adaptation more difficult in small populations. Despite that, if you consider the evolution of the evolutionary potential in the heterogeneous landscape, you find that actually considering this evolution and considering that evolution potential is dynamic as well, is actually making niche expansion easier. So if you look at the same graph as I presented earlier, but as a function of the trait variation, you will have an homogeneous landscape, but allowing this trait variation to evolve in the landscape, you find that it's much more common to evolve a broader niche when you have this dynamic evolution of the variants, and less likely to have a specialist. But interestingly, it's also more likely that you have this bistability area, which means that the evolution of genetic variation will be very sensitive to disturbance events when the evolution potential evolves in the landscape. So now the project with Etsuko is try to move from these simple models to a more complex system with those complex feedbacks with the evolution of evolution potential. And these are my conclusion, and I will stop here and let you read here because I'm late already. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.